Maine's new director of opioid response, Gordon Smith. One of Governor Janet Mills' first actions was to establish a new office aimed at tackling Maine's opioid epidemic. Maine has one of the 10 worst rates of overdose deaths in the nation. Over the past 5 years, more than 1,600 people have died of overdoses, and 8% of the babies born in Maine were born drug affected. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The man spearheading the effort to combat the opioid epidemic is Gordon Smith, a lawyer and longtime executive vice president of the Maine Medical Association. We'll find out what his strategy is, what will be done right away, and what needs funding. We'll also hear from people on the front lines coming up with innovative ideas for those who need help. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Gordon Smith holds the newly created post of Director of Opioid Response for Maine. He was appointed to the position by Governor Janet Mills last month, and he faces the challenging task of leading the state's efforts to combat the opioid epidemic. Gordon Smith joins me in the studio today. He has been Executive Vice President of the Maine Medical Association since 1993. He's a lawyer and has served on numerous boards and often speaks on medical legal issues. Welcome back to Maine Calling, Gordon.
Thank you for having me, Jennifer.
As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have questions for Gordon Smith about how he and the state will tackle Maine's opioid crisis going forward? Do you want to share any personal stories about fighting addiction or about efforts in your community to help? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. You've been in your new position for about a month now. How does one go about getting started with a job like this with no roadmap?
Well, it's both a blessing to have a new position. You're not stepping in anybody else's shoes, and it's a position that we are creating as we go along. So there's no job description. The governor and the senior staff has given me quite a bit of running room to do what we believe needs to be done based upon the governor's 10-point opioid plan. I think we should clarify one thing that's important to know, and that is that although I was with the Medical Association for 39 years, that employment ceased on January 31st so that I could take this position, which began February 4th. So the announcement was a month ago, but this is actually the beginning of my third week. But in truth, we've been at this. I gave my first talk on this topic of OxyContin getting into rural Maine in 2002. Mm. So that's 17 years ago. And then the governor and I really started earnestly working together on this about 3.5 years ago. So I've been preparing for this for quite a while.
So you were hoping that she would create this position, and you were hoping that you would have this responsibility. You've been learning as much as you can.
Well, there's several of us, including some physicians, and I'm a lawyer. I'm not a clinical person. Worked on the 10-point opioid response plan. It's no surprise. Her sister Dora worked on it. My friend Lisa Letourneau, Noah Nesson. So there was a lot of input into the 10 points, and one of the points was to appoint a director of opioid response. At that time, I think we called it just a coordinator. I did not have any intention of that being me. It wasn't till well after the election that she asked that if I would help put together things under each of the 10 points that could be quickly implemented in an executive order or emergency rules or legislation. And of course, I was happy to do that in my role at that time. And then it just kind of became quite clear when we got to the 10th point of there's going to be a director. I was in the right place at the right time because I'd already announced my retirement from the Medical Association. Not many people are in a position to just dump what you're doing, take a major pay cut, and work on the public side. So she's given me a wonderful opportunity to do that. But if I wasn't at this point in my life, I couldn't have done it 20 years ago.
Well, let me talk about that, because you said things that can be 10 points, things can be done quickly, because
yes,
there are things that you can do, frankly, with money and without money.
Yes.
What are we doing as a state right away? What are we doing right now that you can do without getting it through the legislature, yes, without applying for federal grant money, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, we're doing quite a lot. And we announced when we released the executive order about 2 weeks ago now, We announced a number of things that we were doing right now. For instance, we're ordering this week 35,000 doses of Narcan and Naloxone to get out on the street, to get out to the people who need it. We've not done enough harm reduction activities in the state in the past 8 years. We have a plan to put rapid induction Suboxone in every emergency department in the state in all 33 hospitals. We're already up to 4 or 5, but we've offered them recovery coaches, Narcan on the way out the door, incentives to do that. We also are working with every jail and the correctional system to have treatment for the first time available for people who are incarcerated. So those are some of the immediate things, along with establishing the prevention and recovery cabinet. And we've put every department in that, because we found that each department, all 14 departments in state government, have a role to play in this. And so, because the last commissioner was just confirmed this morning, and so now we'll really be moving that quite quickly. So we've done quite a few things right now, and then other things are taking a little bit longer, such as removing the limits on treatment in Maine care, because it got in the statute and in the rules, but we're doing that as fast as we can.
So when you say the limit, it's a 2-year limit, right?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that, of course.
Of course it is, yeah.
Because it started out as a hard 2-year limit in 2012 for methadone and Suboxone, which are the two primary treatment vehicles that we have for people with substance use disorders. But there was a lawsuit filed by by Jack Comart at the Maine Equal Justice. That lawsuit was won by Maine Equal Justice, and so they couldn't just cut off a medication after 2 years. So instead, they imposed prior authorization, and the prior authorization is a hassle for people. And even though many of them are granted, it's probably a barrier to people getting treatment beyond the 2 years. So we have actually language in the supplemental budget that will be heard this week in appropriations tomorrow and Thursday in the public hearings, that if we can eliminate it in the supplemental, that should be emergency legislation, so we can get rid of it quickly in the statute and then start working on emergency rulemaking, because it's stigmatizing and it's not good medicine.
Let's talk about those. Some of the things you just laid out, the 35,000 doses of Naloxone. It seems like a great big number. I mean, what do we know about how often Naloxone is used and could have been used in the past few years?
Well, let me give you an example. The Attorney General's office has been purchasing with money they have from drug settlements and things, and distributing to over 80 law enforcement agencies in the state, Naloxone. Narcan is, we generally refer to as the intranasal form, which is vastly more expensive than Naloxone, which is supplied by needle.
And this is designed to reverse an overdose.
It's a life-saving drug. It doesn't make a person high, but it can keep them alive till we can get them hopefully into recovery. But it definitely is used every day in this country hundreds of times. Now, in the Attorney General's case, when Governor Mills was Attorney General, we were supplying those over 80 departments. Just since 2016, over 650 successful reversals. So that's the only data I have. I've asked for data runs from EMS, which the data people at EMS are getting me. None of this was very transparent until the inauguration. Now we will get all these data sources together and be able to be much more transparent about, okay, where's the NACAN going? How is it being used? How many lives are being saved? How many people get into recovery? It's a harm reduction activity, but it's we can't get people well if they're dead. And so I think that it's very important to get the intranasal and the intramuscular out there. It's interesting, of the 35,000 doses, for instance, 15,000 of those are intranasal, which really are quite easy for a person with no experience to, you know, put into a person's nose and save their life. They're about $75 a kit for two doses. The intramuscular, where you've got to have a needle and a syringe comes and then you have to fill the syringe, that's like a buck and a half with the syringe. So we've bought 20,000 of the intramuscular and 15,000 of the intranasal. And that was about $600,000 between the two. And we have an online order form that will be available this week to get that to offer it to needle exchanges, emergency rooms, federally qualified health centers. Frankly, anybody that can get a vendor number with the state is eligible to receive this life-saving medication.
And that $600,000 comes from?
It comes from one of the many grants that the Office of Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services has. We found quite a bit of money in grants there that some of it needed to be spent within a certain period of time, and it was not spent. And so there is definitely more where that came from in different federal grants. And Maine's still not getting its share, in my opinion, of federal grants. So hopefully a lot of this new federal legislation, you know, New Hampshire's getting like $44 million in one of the major federal programs, and we got like $10 million. Well, why is that? Well, it's because in the previous administration, they didn't really apply for a lot of federal money. They didn't use a lot of federal money, and that money's available to us.
You've been using a phrase a couple times during this conversation, harm reduction. What is meant by that?
Well, you know, it simply acknowledges that people are going to abuse substances, and that it's not prevention. We're not preventing them. We're meeting them where they are. They are actively they're suffering from an active substance use disorder. The two best examples are probably this life-saving medication and needle exchanges. And then into the future at some point in time in this country, maybe safe injection sites. That's not consistent with federal law. There's a lawsuit going on in Philadelphia right now. But that clearly is a harm reduction activity, because if you can find a safe spot for people who are actively using and keep them safe so that if they overdose, they can be saved. And just as significantly, they're not sharing needles so that you don't have outbreaks of hepatitis C, HIV. It's keeping people as healthy as we can under the circumstances. And the real value to me of the needle exchanges, and we have five or six in the state, is that not only do they get clean needles exchanged for needles that have been used, but we have a chance for them to be in contact with healthcare. We have a chance to talk to them about recovery when they're ready, and we can give them NACAN when they leave. So again, Maine's death rate is higher than the national average. We're still losing a person every day, and every one of those is heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. Gordon, it seems to me as though this is just an entirely different way of looking at this problem than the previous administration.
Well, Governor LePage, I've always given him credit for working with the medical community in reducing opioid prescribing for pain. We We had one of the most effective laws. We've seen at least a one-third reduction in opioid prescribing. And he was very active. He was very concerned about the issue. We talked about it all the time. It's just that he did not really believe in harm reduction. He didn't really support some aspects of treatment. He really didn't like methadone clinics. And so it has been a struggle on the treatment and harm reduction side in the past 8 years, and that's probably where we have the most ground to make up.
I know that we don't have enough opportunities for treatment in Maine. Is this the next big obstacle, figuring out not only where the money is going to come from, but how we're going to staff the treatment centers?
We have more treatment than there was. We're making progress. In the governor-elect's 10-point plan, when she was candidate, we had there was a provision in there to increase reimbursement for treatment, because whether it's a methadone clinics or whether it's an opioid health home or whether it's people being paid fee-for-service under what we call Section 65 of Maine Care, they all needed to be adjusted. And so some of that was done in the fall in the previous administration, and those efforts to make it more to incentivize people to provide the care. There's also stigma. There's stigma in the public. There's stigma in the professional community. Many physicians are concerned that they weren't trained in addiction and are not comfortable treating it. And so, and then there's a barrier, the fact that to provide medication-assisted treatment, you have to do an extra 8 hours of education and get what's known as an X waiver. And if you're a nurse practitioner or a PA, you have to do 24 hours. That is a federal law. It's a federal requirement. We've actually asked our delegation to work with us to try to get rid of it. Why? Because on the face of it, it doesn't make sense to me. We take a person in medical school. We put them in their residency, maybe a year fellowship. They come out. On day one, they can prescribe a billion pain pills, opioids, and others. No additional training necessary. But if you want to get one of your patients well, that you might have started down that journey, and now they're in trouble and they're suffering with substance use disorder, to treat them with the most effective medication, you have to go off and take a special course to do that. Now, in medical school, partly Massachusetts passed a law requiring it, and we've somewhat benefited from that because of the Tufts University Main Track program up here in Maine. So we're doing a much better job in medical school of training people about how to treat active addiction. So I don't think a special course should be required. But again, that is going to take an act of Congress to change that. So in the meantime, we've got to, you know, encourage as many people to be providing treatment. And again, there's more than one form of treatment. Everybody's journey is different. Some need a methadone clinic. Some need Suboxone. Some actually can do this based upon an abstinence-based program. So we just need in Maine to have enough options available immediately for people, because when they're finally ready, they may have been actively using for 10 years. Now, finally, the third time we get them in the emergency room, they're ready. That's why we want rapid induction available in the emergency room. But we're losing people. People are dying in Maine, waiting for treatment, and that's unconscionable.
And it sounds to me as though when you say waiting for treatment, you know, I think a lot of people have this idea in their mind's eye, they're waiting to get in to a specialist. And what you're saying, we want primary care physicians trained and ready to provide that treatment.
We'll never do this with specialists. We'd never get there. It has to be done as part of primary care. And then the system of hub and spokes that they're using in Vermont is a good system. They happen to use their methadone clinics as their hub. So the idea is that any primary care physician should be able to treat their patients for substance use disorders with medication if necessary. And if you need further specialty advice, there would be a hub Maine Health is building out a hub and spoke program. Others are doing it as well. And so, the rapid induction in the ED in the emergency departments will help, because we'll be able to say at the end of the year, well, here's 33 places that you can actually go and start. But at the in the emergency department, we can only do it for 72 hours. And then you have to have a warm handoff to primary care or a bridge clinic. We have no bridge clinics in Maine. We have 742 prescribers that do have their X waiver, but the vast majority of those don't see a lot of patients. So we do need to, those numbers do need to climb, but I'll be honest with you, we've had real trouble in the past even mapping what our resources are. And so a lot of the governor's plan does rely upon better data. Where is treatment available? Where are the overdoses taking place? There's a lot of resources available now to map those things. And so we've got a lot of work to do. But in the meantime, we said, let's get Narcan and Naloxone out the door. Let's work with every emergency room, every jail. And in the meantime, work on some of these more complex issues.
We're speaking with Gordon Smith, who is the new Director of Opioid Response for Maine. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does University of New England, with undergraduate Saturday walking tours of UNE's coastal Biddeford campus, une.edu/visit.
Catholic leaders gather in Rome this week to discuss the continuing clergy sexual abuse crisis. Survivors say they are not hopeful meaningful change will come from it.
Those people, to me, are the bigger criminals. They covered up the abuse and they allowed more and more children to be put in harm's way. And that breaks my heart.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio. You've heard the tones before here on Maine Public Radio, and perhaps also on Maine Public Television. Maine Public is the designated primary source for the entire state of Maine Emergency Alert System, which we transmit to all other stations for broadcast to all listeners and viewers all around the state. This is a valuable and important public service tool to help inform, alert, and warn citizens when situations warrant, and Maine Public's statewide infrastructure enables it to fulfill this vital task and public service.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what is the state's game plan for fighting the opioid epidemic? Joining me, Maine's new Director of Opioid Response, Gordon Smith. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. If you'd like to send us an email, make it a brief email, please. And that address is talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Joining me on the line now is Robert McKenzie, who is Chief of Police for the Kennebunk Police Department. Chief McKenzie, thanks for calling in.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the recovery coach training that your police department is doing.
Certainly. Our community actually had done a fundraiser to allow us actually to train folks from within our community and outside our community to be recovery coaches. And because of the amount of money that was raised, more than what we had anticipated, it also allowed us to develop curriculum for our first responders here in our communities as well. So recovery coaches are those that are able to assist people in getting in and staying into recovery, which is very valuable that we need more of, certainly around the state. And then with our first responders, although they can't really be recovery coaches, they could learn recovery coach techniques so that those are tools that they can utilize while they are working with folks that suffer from substance use disorder. So they're on the front lines, and so that type of education is very important for them to have, and we do believe that it will lead to further success in people getting in and staying in recovery.
So the people who are coming to you for these trainings, these are volunteers in the community who are willing to spend their time being a recovery coach for someone else?
That is correct. And in fact, we had an overwhelming response when we advertised for recovery coaches. Because, like you said, it is volunteer at this point. And first go around, we had like 30 signed up for the initial class, but then we have a waiting list, and it's my understanding at this point we have a waiting list of 70 people for the next recovery coach class, which is coming up in April.
So I know that this is very new, but tell me about the recovery coaches and the work they're doing so far. Do you have any stories of what they've been able to do?
Well, let me give you this example to start with. Like, one of our police officers here in Kennebunk was very interested in taking the full 4-day recovery coach class. And again, knowing that she couldn't really be a recovery coach, but yet she knew that those tools would assist her in her work here at the PD. So I certainly encouraged her, and she did that class. And then when she's dealt with certainly several folks out in our community, and two come to mind that, you know, both had suffered several heroin overdoses and certainly were revived. But she was able to, you know, start a conversation and build a rapport with these folks, and, you know, said, when you're ready, reach out to me. I want to help you get help. And both of them did just that. And she was able to pair them up with recovery coaches, again, which are those folks are going to help them, you know, get to and stay in recovery. So that's, you know, I think that's great. With regard to the recovery coach class that we just recently had, they're not those folks are not certified as of yet, because after the 4-day initial class, there has to be an ethics class, and then there has to be many hours of supervised training before they actually get their certification. But we're in the midst right now of setting up those ethics classes and working with PRCC, which is out of Portland, hoping that they'll be able to assist us with as an umbrella and putting these recovery coaches kind of under them and assist them in getting the supervised hours they need.
Are the recovery coaches people who have recovered from a problem themselves, or are these just regular people who want to do something?
Both. Yes, certainly. It's very valuable for folks that are in long-term recovery to be a recovery coach, because number one, I'm sure it helps them throughout stay in recovery, but in addition, it does give them credibility to the folks that they're working with, because they've been there and done that. So it can be very, very powerful for both. But also, there are people in the community that don't suffer from substance use disorder that are just as valuable and can be like a mentor and a coach and assist these folks.
From a law enforcement point of view, what do you want to emphasize to Gordon Smith about what you see as critical to dealing with the opioid epidemic?
Well, I think what's come out of the governor's office has been, you know, straight on what we need here in the state of Maine. I was very excited to see the addition of, you know, 250 recovery coaches throughout the state and to have them placed into places such as ERs. I heard Gordon mention in the jails as well. I think that's extremely valuable, because many people that are in jail have lost their support system and they have no guidance. So, you know, if they get out of jail and if they were using substances such as opioids or heroin, you know, it's very difficult for them not to want to go back to that. But if they have some support system in place prior to their release and they have that help to keep them on the straight and narrow and a resource for them to direct them to certain resources, then it's certainly going to save a lot of money in the long run. I do a lot of talking on this subject. And just for the York County Jail, it's $108 a day to house an inmate at the York County Jail. And the vast majority of the folks that are in that jail are there in one way, shape, or form because of substance use disorder. So if you start treating it at that level and get these people into recovery, then we're going to save money in the long run, because they're not going to hopefully wind back up in the jail.
Gordon, do you have any thoughts for Chief McKenzie?
Well, the Chief McKenzie and I had a chance to have a discussion about 2 weeks ago at the Chief's meeting, and I'm very impressed with what they're doing in Kennebunk, and I should have mentioned earlier the 250 recovery coaches, and I'll come back to that. But I think I'm very impressed generally with the number of people in law enforcement who have recognized that primarily these individuals are not criminals. Primarily, they're sick, and it's a chronic disease, and they're really trying hard to get them better.
Chief McKenzie, thank you so much for calling in. That's Bob McKenzie, who is chief of police in Kennebunk. And on the line with us now is Kayla Kalel. She is with a group called Young People in Recovery in Brewer, where she is the co-chapter leader. Thanks for joining us, Kayla.
Yeah, hi.
Tell us about Young People in Recovery. What do you do?
Sure. So Young People in Recovery is a national grassroots organization for people in or seeking recovery from substance use disorder. And we have chapters all over the United States. I represent the Brewer chapter. We hold bi-monthly workshops in the Bangor area on recovery messaging, housing, employment, education. We also do periodically naloxone training, heart cleanups, and we also connect people to resources in the community.
How did you get involved with helping others in recovery?
I first heard Andrew Kazulis present recovery messaging, and I loved the fact that he identified as a person in long-term recovery, and that was the first time I'd ever heard anybody talk about their recovery openly in a way that wasn't stigmatizing. And I think that when we represent ourselves that way, we really get our power back and can put a face on recovery in a way that's meaningful.
Kayla, is there anything you'd like to tell Gordon Smith as he sets out to implement a statewide strategy to tackle the opioid crisis?
Yeah, I mean, I think I listened in on the first part of the conversation about this, and I think that you guys really have are off to a great start. I mean, I think that a big part of getting people the help that they need is just accepting them for where they're at and really, like I said before, ending the stigma and taking away language that is stigmatizing. And a lot of times we don't even realize that we're using stigmatizing language. So really just being aware of what we're saying and when we're saying it, and getting people connected, because a lot of times there are resources out there, but we don't know about them. So just really being aware of different ways we can connect people in, you know.
And Gordon, do you have thoughts for Kayla?
Well, Kayla, thank you for what you do. I'm very impressed with the Young People in Recovery organizations. I know Andrew well, Matt Braun, many of you, and some of the best work going on in Maine is going on in these types of organizations. And because, frankly, I'm not in recovery, it's really important that I have opportunities to talk to and meet with people in recovery, families. And we're going to do everything we can to support you, Kayla, and your organizations. As I go around the state and say I'm there representing Governor Mills and she would want to thank you for what you do, I always go on to say, how can the state be a better partner for you? How can we support what you're doing? And that's been a very powerful message here the last few weeks as I've been representing the governor and the state of Maine, because people hadn't heard that lately.
Kayla, thanks so much for calling in. That's Kayla Kalel with Young People in Recovery in Brewer. We're going to go to Jane, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Hi. Hold on. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 25-year-old daughter who has been battling with substance abuse all her life. From the age of 15, really. Excuse me. And she's been through many, many treatment programs. We've been to residential program. We went to the Karen Foundation in Pennsylvania. She did the juvenile program there. She's done Outward Bound type programs. All kinds of anything I could think of. We've done IOP programs. She's been to Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcoholics Anonymous. Just doesn't seem to, you know, it'll help temporarily, but we can't get anything to keep her off alcohol and drugs permanently. I'm just wondering. So a situation I had was yesterday that she was willing to enter a treatment program, but I couldn't find anything for her. You know, looking for something that you can enter into that day. And then just that help just wasn't there.
Jane, I'm so sorry. Gordon, you're hearing stories.
Every day, yeah. I mean, the goal is to certainly have treatment available when the patient is ready. And that's, we hear this all the time. I said earlier in the first half hour that we have too many people that we lose while they're awaiting treatment. And so we know we have to beef up the treatment capacity so that when your daughter is ready for recovery, that we have an option for her. We also hope to have, it's in the executive order, we hope to have a phone number that people can call regionally. That's not just a 211 information line, but that's a referral line. We need that person that who answers the phone to be well-trained and to also have access on their computer screen to where treatment's available right now. And when this isn't going to happen in the next week, but we're certainly going to do everything we can to build up our capacity. Don't give up on your daughter.
Yes, Jane, good luck to you. We do need to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com and Martins Point Healthcare. Dedicated to providing the highest quality care and coverage to the people of Maine, offering Generations Advantage Medicare plans. Learn how you can enroll at generationsadvantage.com.
On the next Speaking in Maine, ground truth in a post-truth era.
The need for new models in journalism and the lack of support for them has now hit a ripsaw of reality.
Charles Sennett is the founder, chief executive officer, and editor of the Ground Truth Project. He spoke at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Northport about the power of local journalism. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
That's coming up shortly, right after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. This spring and summer, Maine Public News will be on the road, stopping communities all around the state to talk to you about the important issues in your community and what topics are most important for us to report on. More on that as we get closer. Right now, as a lead-up to the tour, we have a statewide survey we'd like you to fill out. It only takes a few minutes. Visit mainepublic.org and click on Events and the Tell Me More survey. Or if you aren't online, call Audience Services, 1-800-884-1717, and we'll get one right out to you. Thanks. Your participation will ensure Maine Public News serves you better in the months ahead.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, how the state is addressing the opioid crisis. Joining us today, Gordon Smith, Director of Opioid Response for Maine. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Gordon, your title is Director of Opioid Response, and the opioid epidemic is indeed that, with so many deaths, so many babies being born affected. But this is really broader than heroin and fentanyl, isn't it?
It's about people abusing substances and having substance use disorders, whether it, and it frequently starts with addiction to nicotine, which is a very difficult substance to get off. And so it's much broader than opioids. We talk about opioids because people can identify that as kind of a proxy for everything else. But, for instance, opioid deaths are actually down. That's a good thing. But deaths from cocaine and meth are up. Cocaine and meth are not opioids. And so we recognize that, again, we use the term, but we're dealing with a much broader list of substances, and we haven't even talked today about prevention. We wouldn't have to talk about treatment and harm reduction if we could, you know, stop our sons and daughters somehow from birth to age 26, make sure they don't go down that road. And, you know, it's a brain disease. It may be a choice you make the first time to use it, but once it's hooked into your brain and it's changed the chemicals in your brain, You will live this with this for the rest of your life, but you can get into recovery, and we have many good people that are thousands of people in recovery who are doing well.
One of them was a guest on Maine Calling a few months ago, and she's writing in today on Facebook. This is Courtney Allen. She writes, expanding access to recovery residences is the ninth point on Governor Mills' 10-point plan. Currently, more than 50% of recovery residences are located in Cumberland County. Have you explored funding mechanism to expand access to recovery housing in rural communities?
Yes, we have, Courtney, and I think you might have been present when I spoke to the Maine Association of Recovery Residences. It's something that, you know, in my background as a healthcare lawyer, I really knew very little about recovery residences. But I sat down with Senator Shenna Bellows, who was my own senator, and looked at her bill from 2 years ago that died on the appropriations table. And we absolutely have a plan to, that bill is back in. We hope to get it funded. Hope to have some housing vouchers for people who are income eligible for and have substance use disorders, and we need and also encourage the residencies to be certified under the National Association of Recovery Residences. And part of that would be taking patients who are on medication assisted therapy, because the majority of recovery residences, whether they're called sober homes or halfway houses or recovery residences, do not take a patient if you're on medication-assisted therapy, which the science and medicine tells us is the person's best chance at long-term recovery.
We'll go to Scott, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Basically the question I have is, this seems to always come down, you know, we're always talking about resources. And so it's always taxpayer money that seems to be paying for everything, and we never have any conversation about any penalties that are going to go against DuPont or you know, doctors that went crazy subscribing all of this, you know, these opioids to people. They have no penalty. They pay none of this bill that happens. I believe in recovery. I have a family member in recovery that's actually in a transition house because there's not enough places and money. So this, we never seem to hear about how these people are going to pay an extra penalty. The oil company spills oil on downtown Main Street. The oil company has to pay to clean that up.
Sure, Scott. I suspect lots and lots of people have the same question you have. Gordon, is there any effort to, you know, have the pharmaceutical manufacturers who
absolutely
put them
there's
out
a,
there?
There's a big trial going on in Massachusetts right now against the Sackler family that founded Purdue Pharma. And there's lots of lawsuits around the country. Maine is active in some of those. So I guess, Scott, what we need to do is we need to talk more about it, because absolutely – They are one of the causative factors. It's not the only thing, but a lot of harm was done. If you read the literature, the books like Dreamland by Sam Kunis and Dope Sick by Beth Massey, and it is unconscionable what some of the manufacturers and distributors did to the rural counties in this nation. And they should pay a big price for that.
Scott, thanks for your call. We'll move to Mike, who's calling from Farmington. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Gordon. This is Mike in Farmington.
Hi, Mike.
I'm in long-term recovery, and I have a really big concern, and I also get very angry when I see all of the money that's being spent in the state of Maine goes almost directly to Suboxone or methadone. And in the early 60s, when I came through recovery, all of the programs were run by recovering addicts. They are still successful today, and they have a very good and high success rate. And I just feel that putting people on Suboxone and methadone, it was first, you go into treatment. If that didn't work, you went on Suboxone or methadone. I mean, there's people on Suboxone and methadone now 8, 10, 20 years. There's thousands of people in recovery out there that can be utilized and gotten involved in this whole recovery effort. It would create jobs. Years ago, you didn't need all of these degrees to get involved in recovery. You can run therapeutic houses then. So I guess my question is to you is why is all this money being directly put into Suboxone?
Well, I'm glad, Mike, that you called, because there's a lot of people that share your opinion that and I try to all I can say is that the governor and I, because the governor is from your hometown, I mean, we are open-minded, and we realize that each person has to have their own road to recovery. But Suboxone and methadone have been shown to be quite effective for many, many people. Now, I agree with you that the AA model has saved millions of people's lives, and that if abstinence might well be a preferred approach for those that have good counseling, good support systems. And I agree that Suboxone and methadone are not, it's not just medication. If you're not surrounding that with housing and counseling and getting underneath why the person was abusing substances in the first place, then you're not going to be successful. So I think we need to conclude that point with simply saying there is a role for both. There is a role for abstinence-based programs that are voluntarily based, and there is a role for medication-assisted treatment as well.
Mike, thanks for your call. We have an email from Kate. She writes, I'd like to know if Gordon Smith is familiar with Section 35, a program in Massachusetts where a family member, healthcare provider, are able to petition the court to have their loved one with substance use disorder committed for care or rehab. I have a son with a long history of the disorder and was asked by his providers in the Mass VA system to implement this procedure. He had experienced 2 overdoses in 1 week. I went to Massachusetts, did this, and now he's in the 3rd week inpatient in one of these facilities. He's engaging in treatment and willing to go to a 6-week program. He was unable to do this on his own and really needed to have someone take control of his out-of-control life. I have a professional background in substance use disorders, a longtime public health nurse for the city of Portland. We were always told that the person needed to be ready and not coerced into treatment. Sometimes they just can't get there and need that push. I have hope for the first time in many years.
Well, that is a great point. Charlie Baker, the governor of Massachusetts, when he was elected, I think first in 2014, put together a task force of people, a commission, if you will. We've had commissions in Maine. That's why we're not doing one now. We've had the Maine Opiate Collaborative and then the Legislative Task Force. But he did come down quite hard on the ability of people to be coerced into treatment. Some of his more radical proposals, like, keeping them in the ED against their will, did not pass. But I don't disagree with anything you've said, and you've experienced it. But I can tell you that those types of approaches are very controversial in the legislature. And so while there's been some ability to do that on the mental health side, on the substance use side, it's not been tried, and there would be significant pushback from the civil liberties organizations, particularly the ACLU, and probably NAMI Maine as well. Maybe. So again, I can tell you that the governor and I talk about this frequently, that we don't know everything. And one of the great things about the fact that I'm creating this job as we go along, I can look at what all 49 states are doing and what other countries are doing. And anything that we think might save a life in Maine, we're not going to rule out. So we'll take a look at everything, and we encourage people to send in their ideas. We don't know it all. We know quite a bit, but we want to hear from you.
All right. Well, we're almost out of time. Scott, we're going to try to squeeze in your question. Go ahead.
Scott from Brunswick?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I spent 15 years working as a drug and alcohol therapist in Pennsylvania. And I think the issue that was raised about coercion into care is very, very important. It's a vital element. We simply cannot allow people to go through harm reduction and then free them to go back out and continue their habit of addiction. These folks are in terrible trouble. And if we can get them into treatment, even if they're coerced, we've got a chance to work with them. I mean, it's highly irresponsible for the government simply to set up these programs that turn into revolving doors. I mean, we've got to consider when harm reduction becomes aiding and abetting addiction. I realize that's a controversial thing to say, but you know, it's not just good enough to have a needle exchange program and do nothing else with it except hope that they get into treatment. And I've seen this with a family member as well. I've got a good friend who's got a daughter who's in jail right now, and she's happy to be there because she's freed from her addiction for a while. In fact, she wants to stay in jail because she can't get into treatment.
Scott, thank you so much for your perspective. Anything else to add, Gordon, beyond what you said to
the
last speaker?
No, I think we want everybody's opinion, and that's a powerful one, and we'll take all that into consideration. There's a lot of people that share that opinion.
There are a lot of people calling and emailing this hour who aren't going to be able to get through because we really are almost out of time. How do they contact you and your office?
Gordon.Smith@maine.gov is my email address, and it's probably the best way to reach me. You can also send messages through the governor's website. And if you mention opioid in those communications, apparently they all come to me. And I try my best to get back to everyone in one way or the other, whether it's a phone call or an email in response. We really do want to hear from you. This is a statewide problem. It is a problem in communities. And it won't be resolved without every citizen, you know, doing something they can, whether they train as a recovery coach or go down and volunteer at a local shelter. We need all hands on board.
All right. And one little tiny thing we have not been able to talk about, but Medicaid expansion, important part of this puzzle that we're putting together in the years coming forward.
The single most important thing that Maine could do, because it will provide coverage to maybe as many as 10,000 to 15,000 people with substance use disorders, 70,000 or 80,000 people altogether. And because access, having insurance does affect your ability to access care.
All right. Well, Gordon Smith, thank you so much for joining us today. Gordon is director for Opioid Response, is a lawyer, and previous to this job, longtime executive vice president of the Maine Medical Association. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. This program will be broadcast again tonight at 8. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.